The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's The Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City. Today, my guest in the second part of our program, and we'll devote more time than normal to our guest because it's a conversation with remarkable minds. He is Dr. Paul Epstein. He's a physician and director of the Center for Health and Global Environment at Harvard Medical School. He's worked in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. And we're going to talk about the climate changes on our planet and their influence on changes in our health and the future health of people. Up to this point, many people have been in denial about the significance of global warming or environmental changes, and therefore they can't make that connection. We will make the connection why, as it gets colder, as it gets warmer and wetter and drier, all of this will begin to impact our well-being. Conversations with Remarkable Minds, extended interview from Harvard with Dr. Paul Epstein, coming in the second part of our program. My issue of the day is 18 signs the collapse of society is accelerating. If you live in many areas of the United States, such as the Upper West Side, where I just walked in Manhattan, you have a very highly educated professional group of people, architects, engineers, business people, lawyers, corporate people, financial industry people. They live in very good affluence. The apartments go from a low end of $1 million to $20 million. Rents go from a little tiny studio of $1,500 to $7,000 for an apartment. You would never know there's a problem in America walking down the streets of the Upper West Side. I filmed yesterday in Riverside Park. I filmed for several documentaries. One is the new one that we're almost finished with in post-production. I want to do a few pickup shots. I want to talk with people in the streets of the Upper West Side. Do they know how many homeless people are living in Riverside Park? In the daytime, bikers, strollers, couples hand in hand, children yelling and playing and screaming. You would never know there's a problem overlooking the beautiful Hudson River with the sailboats. But at 5 o'clock in the morning, it's a different scene. Long lines of homeless people lined up quietly, waiting at a water fountain so they can brush their teeth and wash themselves and prepare themselves for the day ahead. From underneath rocks, up a ledge, up near the Riverside Drive, they come where at night it's safe. In the daytime, they're told, move on. You're not wanted in the neighborhood. You scare our children. I've spoken with these people. Out of respect for their plight, I chose not to film them in this line, but I brought their story to their neighbors. I was surprised by the response of people on the Upper West Side to the plight of the people. They were indifferent, or they thought that somehow these people should be doing more. That old Glenn Beck, if you're poor, it's your problem, and you put yourself in being poor. No, they did not. So it's what you see and what you do not see within a society. So when we do not see a collapse, when we only see prosperity, when we have enough food for all of our needs and those of our friends and family, when we have variety and we can afford it, how then do we position that reality against the other reality of those who are struggling? Where for them the inflation that is supposed to be at zero has gone up, well, for example, with meat and milk and sugar and coffee, the things that the average person eats, anywhere from 16 to 120%. But wages have not increased. And land is being taken out from farming and put into biofuels. a complete fraud. Biofuel should not be used. The land should not be planted in a corn or sugar beet or something for biofuels because it's not energy efficient, it is not saving us on pollution, and it's not cost effective. But the subsidies are there. Follow the money, and you'll finally end up at the truth. None of this was in the consciousness of people that I spoke with throughout the city yesterday. So today, the signs of collapse for those who are seeing it firsthand, a message for those who are in denial. Yesterday, as I was walking up the Broadway, I went down and took a break in my schedule, as I frequently will do at night, and to catch a play. I saw Robin Williams' Bengal Tiger at the Baghdad Zoo. I left an intermission. I didn't like it for a lot of reasons, but that doesn't mean you wouldn't like it. It was very existential, and I didn't think very deep intellectually. As I'm walking up, the streets were blocked. I had never seen that much police protection for a president ever, but Obama was in town. They blocked off three whole blocks. Why? How much reality does the person in the White House now or former presidents know about what's really happening in real America? Do they have any of those real Americans in the White House to counsel them? Never. Only when it comes time to eating a hot dog or eating a pizza in the local restaurant to get the votes to show that we're like you. No. You're not like them. At all. On any level. And that's why we have today an enormous class conflict that will in time, I believe, and unfortunately, will lead to class warfare. The media is not covering it. It's as if it doesn't exist. I'll give you some heads up of why it does. That's our show today. Now, on Monday evening, I've set aside a very interesting set of commentaries, and the show's only on commentaries, only on really serious issues, so it's really only for people who want to have a very scholarly, in-depth, but humanistic look at our problems, and most importantly, our solutions. And I'm going to be talking about the anguish in the American dream, how we can solve these problems, and also what is the best solution for Afghanistan. I can promise you no one, not a soul listening, will have thought of this. And I will introduce you to what is happening in Eurasia and the countries that could make a difference if Americans only understood that we are the problem, not the solution on any level. But unless we understand who else is out there, what they're doing, what they would do if we got out of there, and how we could actually bring peace and prosperity to that area for the people there. But the thought that America can be a part of the problem, not the solution, it isn't possible to get this into the media or the official mindset. In our mind, we are manifest destiny. We are the solution to all problems. Think so? Listen Monday night, 7 p.m., over ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. It'll be an hour, like each hour that I do on Monday night, that's also on our archives, in case you miss it, that can give you a different perspective. Let's begin. Soft drinks. Well, soft drinks are bad. We know that. But you don't see them with a warning label. This could cause diabetes. This could cause cancer. This could cause local infections. This could adversely affect your brain chemistry. All of which are true. This can cause oxidative stress, which can cause macular degeneration, cataracts, and glaucoma. This can clog your arteries. This can cause lesions in your arteries. This can cause inflammation in your pancreas. Also true. So we're not going to stop drinking soft drinks because we have not been encouraged by policymakers or opinion leaders that they're bad. Here's the latest study for those of you who, however, don't need official approval to make good choices. From the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, quote, soft drinks can damage your body in 3 weeks. I'll quote. A new study has found that drinking 2 cans of soda a day can increase your chance of developing heart disease and then diabetes in 3 weeks. 3 weeks. In the study, volunteers who drank 2 soft drinks a day saw a rapid rise in their blood sugar levels and a chemical linked to heart trouble. It also said that even drinking moderate amounts of sugary beverages caused a potentially dangerous change in cholesterol. They started with healthy men, ages 20 to 50, who drank, who had normal cholesterol. It created bad cholesterol, the kind that breaks into small particles, making them more likely to cause heart disease. Quote, this is from the conclusion of the article. Only a few weeks of moderate consumption is sufficient to increase risk markers. So now let's put this in perspective. I remember when I debated the people making saccharin. I debated the scientists they brought forth on my radio show in 1977 to say that saccharin was not a problem. I showed evidence it was. I showed evidence it caused enlargement of the spleen and defects in the liver of mice, that it caused precancerous lesions in the kidneys of those mice. They said it did not. Time has shown that I was right, they were wrong. The trouble is, they had the support of the American Dietetic Association, they had support of our government and agencies, the FDA, the media. People didn't want to stop drinking a low-calorie soft drink or eating low-calorie confections. So people went with their comfort instead of the truth. Then I was told in a debate, and by the way, that's when, during about a 10-year period, from 1970 to 1980, I did over 400 debates. And it was always the same. They would hire scientists who would come forward and say that you should believe us, public, because we're medical doctors and he's not. Of the public, some, I'm sure, were convinced that if you're not a doctor, that you don't have the knowledge. Well, but I just laid out the truth. And they would say, but you realize you'd have to drink 546 cans of cola before you'd have any problems? And I said, that's the same argument the tobacco industry said. You'd have to smoke 10 packs of cigarettes a day for 10 years before you could show an association with lung cancer. But what if you smoke 4 packs a day, or 3 packs, or 2 packs, or 1 pack, so you get your cancer in 30 years, or 40 years, like my brother did, lung cancer and throat cancer? We all know now that virtually all the scientists, all the governmental agencies, the American Medical Association, a very dangerous man who worked for the AMA for decades, a man named Fishbein, who ran the AMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association, which really should have been labeled as porn, medical porn, because it encouraged women to do things that were abusive to their body and for profit for the medical pimps at the time. I remember the ad. I still have it. 47,000 doctors recommend Lucky Strikes for women because it soothes the throat and calms the nerves. I would imagine in 1890 these would be the same doctors suggesting that women go in for a quarter, not much, even in those times. You could relieve your stress and anxiety, or what was considered hysteria or womb fury, by having pelvic manual manipulation and receiving a drug. That went on for about 30 years. It finally stopped only because Sears Roebuck brought up the first vibrator. Pelvic manual manipulation is masturbation. Countless women in America went to their doctors to have them masturbate them, but also gave them opium and cocaine. And so imagine today someone comes home and says, how was your day? Good. Went to the doctor. He masturbated me and gave me some cocaine. Oh, that's nice. I don't think so, unless you're Republican, then that would be expected for anyone else. No, that wouldn't be a good thing. Now, that was considered the best treatment for women. In fact, some women in America, I have this in a new film that I just finished about women's health throughout the decades and who's played on it and how they manipulate it. But women would actually have their ovaries removed and put in formaldehyde on their mantles. So when people came to their home, they could point and say, see, we're a womb fury free household. And womb fury was hysteria. and grounds for having a woman committed to a mental institution and having her ovaries removed were that she was either depressed or argumentative, or that she had insomnia. So if your husband didn't like what you said, she could see that you had your ovaries removed. Imagine that. Now, men weren't encouraged to have their testicles removed and say, see, in this house, we can all sing a cappella, and there's no testosterone fury. No, it didn't happen that way. I think it would have been a good idea, maybe for about 10 years, if all the men had their penises removed, and starting at the White House, put up there, and all members of Congress, we should only elect eunuchs to office. Think of the official White House and Congressional Committee choir. It would be angelic. We could have them doing Gregorian chants. And getting back to soft drinks, because I think some of these people were rectally born or immaculately conceived. It depends upon which day you catch them on. We should only have members of Congress and the President drink soft drinks, no one else. All right, give them 300 cans a day. In any case, it didn't take 536 cans over 30 years, 2 cans a day for 3 weeks. All right, that's how it works. And finally, up here, leucine, which is an amino acid, an essential amino acid, according to this new study from a major peer-reviewed journal, Harvard Medical School, a new study, quote, has indicated that adding the amino acid leucine, L-E-U-C-I-N-E, to the diet may help combat pre-diabetes and metabolic syndrome. That's good. This was done at the Joslin Diabetes Center. So that's easy to get, inexpensive, non-toxic, and it can help you. One more. Use rosemary leaves for glossy hair and good circulation. Rosemary is a wonderful smelling and multi-purposed herb. The leaves, which have been used in traditional cures for centuries, and the herb stimulates hair growth and makes hair smell delightful. Rosemary is said to enhance the memory by improving blood circulation. Now, rosemary tea can be used as a conditioning hair rinse. The herb will help to combat dandruff, and rosemary vinegar applied to the hair will make hair gloriously glossy, especially dark hair. And combined with horsetail, rosemary is said to aid hair loss recovery in cases where hair loss is due to stress or worry. So, by the way, there's a lot of things I would recommend rosemary for. It improves circulation. It helps you if you're coming down with a cold, and it's also good if you have cold and achy and painful joints. It's very good for memory. Researchers have found that rosemary contains estrogenic acid, which can fight off free radical damage in the brain, improves memory, and can help prevent strokes and conditions like Alzheimer's. That's a carnosic acid, excuse me. And one of the properties of rosemary is lift the mood and help you out of your depression. Add 15 drops of rosemary oil to a warm bath to ease muscular tension, improve circulation, and boost your mood. If you take it internally as an herb, it can help your digestion, help turn off gallbladder inflammation, and you can use it as a gargle for sore throats. I'm Gary Nall, back in a moment. Please stay with us. Well, I'm running down the road trying to loosen my load. I got 7 women on my mind. 4 that want to own me, 2 that want to stone me, 1 says she's a friend of mine. Take it easy, take it easy. Don't let the sound of your own wheels drive you crazy. I'd like to welcome you. I'm Gary Nall. I'm going to be doing something to help those people in the audience understand homesteading and what's going to be happening with homesteading projects, my own included. It's the first of a 5 steps to getting people to go through a transition from where they're at to where they ideally would like to be. This is only for people who are looking at doing actual homesteading projects, from gardening and farming to baking and food preparation. I'll be meeting with them 1 o'clock in our Westside office on Sunday in person, but also because many people listening cannot be there, I've set up a phone line where you'll call in and you'll be able to listen in on a conference call. You can go to Progressive Radio Network. I believe it's on Progressive Radio Network. The information on how to get that call on Sunday at 1 o'clock. Or you can call and speak with Jason here in the studio, and he can give you information on that. But it's only for people who are interested in doing homestead projects. It's not for the general public. Jason, what's your number?
646-926-5428. And just one request I'm asking our listeners. We need a volunteer this Saturday, approximately about 3 p.m., to go to Gary's 92nd Street location and bring over some chairs for us to over here into the 83rd Street.
Yeah, we're
going
to have a packed house. But also, anyone wanting to see how I do filming, I'm going to be filming after my lecture on Saturday, tomorrow. We have our health support group meeting at 1 o'clock, and I'm going to be lecturing there along with Dr. Feldman and Dr. Robbins and Dr. Michael Ellner. And then I'm going to be filming and all around Manhattan. I didn't get everything done yesterday because of the rain. Mm-hmm. We only had to wait till it stopped. So that'll be fun as well.
Great. Please call me at 646-926-5428 if you have a van and then can really help us. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Joining us in the studio is Elizabeth. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hello, Gary. Hello. We've been asked, what are the ways that we can turn around our mess in America, starting with the most obvious, please?
I believe that we should take one thing at a time. And that one thing is that we could put at least 5 million Americans back to work if we simply gave the same loans under the same conditions to small qualified business persons. As long as 3 things are done. A, you can only hire people locally. So when you have the loan, you have to hire local people. What you manufacture is manufactured or created locally for Americans. And that you then give people a 2-year grace period before they pay back the principal and charge them 0.25% interest. And have local committees of other businesses examine the loans to see which ones are most likely to work in their community, and we could have millions of Americans back to work. And that's just the beginning, because once you're successful at something and you've gotten through the first maybe year or two, then you can expand that and hire more people. But also you're de-ghettoizing America. You're getting businesses back into America. And stop the major corporations from getting all the subsidies and all the free bailouts as they did with $13.3 trillion. That's the first thing I would do. Then secondly, to de-ghettoize America, I would go in and I would start a major Marshall Plan in all urban areas that are blighted. How would I do that? First, I would not allow outside contractors. The game that is played, Elizabeth, is that people who get these government contracts are always insiders. They're the ones who pay large amounts of money, like the ambassadorships to France and England. Those are all wealthy business people who pay enough money and they buy themselves an ambassadorship. That's who gets the money on these contracts. You want local people to get the jobs, so you create nonprofit foundations in each community in the United States, run by people within the community. And you do it where you have independent people come in from different walks of life, architects, builders, planners, urban planners, sociologists, and you say, okay, what can we do to make this whole area, this 100-block area, live again? Take all the lots that are abandoned, level them out, clean them up, and then make urban gardens. Take all the buildings and put solar panels on the roofs to make them energy efficient. Take all abandoned buildings, gut them, and those that are structurally capable, rebuild them with quality natural materials, which help support the green movement, hiring only local people that supports the labor pool, have schools that are set up for trades, plumbing, electrical, and have local masters in plumbing, in masonry, in roofing, in flooring and tiling and wood finishing. Teach a whole generation skills that they can use and use in their community, and then have lotteries where people will have thousands upon thousands of apartments which they can then rent, can own. The moment you own it, you've shifted it from de-ghettoizing and giving people who don't have resources a chance to have quality of life to now you're going to gentrify the neighborhood. You're going to open it to speculators to come in and buy all these apartments, flip them, or charge outrageous amounts of money because, oh, now look how we've rehabilitated the neighborhood. In every block that you rehabilitate, you should also have assisted living centers. You should have a culture, theater, arts, gyms, social counseling, drug counseling, life coaching, public support for helping children and their parents. So if a parent had to work and couldn't afford a daycare center, there'd be a more holistic daycare center. You should do that throughout. Within 5 years, you've just completely changed the entire socioeconomic standing of a ghetto. Now, the gangs are not going to be prospering as they were before because you've taken away a lot of the reasons people join gangs. Because you've given gainful employment, you've cleaned up the neighborhood, you've given people educations, you've given them a chance to change their life, you've given them a place to live in quality living where they can't be thrown out, they can't be dispossessed. And you have standards, of course. You hold people to a higher standard. This isn't about a giveaway program. This is about show that you deserve this opportunity and we will help you. We have the resources. We have the manpower underutilized. We have the need that has not been recognized. This also would clean up our infrastructure. Then I would take another group of people and have them work on reforesting America. Every state needs about 20 to 30 million trees. I would clean up all of the toxic sites. I would clean up the rivers, redo the bridges, the tunnels, the water mains, and shift those over. Put wind everywhere you can, solar everywhere you can, and certainly in New York, you could 100% in time generators into the water that would service all of this electrical need. You could take electric, coal, and nuclear out of the equation within 10 years completely. Then start a back-to-the-farm movement where you subsidize by giving, like there used to be, 40 acres and a mule. Today, you don't give 40 acres and a mule. What you give is a person 100 acres plus you give them the tools that are needed, like tractors and heirloom seeds, to plant, providing that 20% of everything they grow goes back to the society, to the local towns and communities, to food banks to feed the homeless people, and then you get to keep what else you grow, and you sell that on markets. We could open public markets, farmers markets. We could get at least 5 million Americans back on farms. We would have the greatest resurgence of a rural agricultural experiment in American history. So then you're reclaiming the land organically, no genetic engineering. You're getting families back and you're helping them get started. Because as they make money, a part of that money goes against the cost of giving that land in the first place. And by shutting down the 727 foreign bases we don't need, by cutting off the subsidies to the military-industrial spy complex, by the energy cartels, by the insurance industry, by the pharmaceutical industry, you're saving $2 trillion. So you take the $2 trillion you're saving because you're giving it as a form of corporate socialism, which they hate to hear that. We're against socialism. Okay, are you against the fire department as socialism? Public schools that you grew up in, Glenn Beck, and the rest of you hypocrites? You against that? Do you ever get up in class and say, you socialist school teachers, you're teaching me principles about American history and civics? How dare you do that? I want Milton Friedman. You know, and yeah, and the disaster his philosophy and Ayn Rand's caused? Are you against, what happens, Glenn, if you're, Sean Hannity, if your house is burning down but you didn't pay your privatized insurance? so the privatized fire department doesn't come to put out your fire. What if your neighbor's house is on fire and they run over? Sean, can you help me? Yeah. What's your insurance? I don't have any insurance. I didn't know we had to have insurance. Yeah. It's privatized now. Everything in America is privatized. That's what we support. But my kids are in the house. Sorry. Can't help you. So understand the gross, palpable hypocrisy of those who say they're against socialism. You cannot exist as a society if you do not have a common good that is known as the commons. Take away the word socialism, put in the word commons. A common park. That's socialism. We don't want Central Park. Absolutely not. Sean Hannity will lose his erection today thinking of a private Central Park. How dare you, Gary? And all, we want a privatized park. We want someone to own that park. And you can't go in there. You can't take your dog in there. Your dog pees in that park. We're charging you extra. I see. So we shouldn't have, what about the beach? Privatize it. I see. Okay. What about the sidewalks? Aren't we allowed to walk down the sidewalks? No. We privatize them. Halliburton. You gotta pay. You gotta pay. Can I sit on that bench? See the meter? Ka-ching, ka-ching. Money, 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 money. God, I mean, if you got a lobotomy, you'd be smarter than these people. Because they think they're smart because the Tea Party and the rest of these people all get together and they're inane because they do not step back and examine the lack of reason and logic in their own arguments. We need public schools. We need a public fire department and Coast Guard, and we need things that we can all share in common for the common good. Then take away what we socialize, pay for, but we don't benefit, they privatize. So we pay for them to have the highest priced drugs in the world. Why is it then that we cannot get them to drop the price of their drugs down to where we can afford them if we need them? I'm opposed to most medications, except those that are needed. But I also believe that through Medicare and Medicaid and veterans, if you need a medication, a doctor or a hospital should be able to purchase at the lowest price, a generic version. You can't do that today because of how they wrote the Medicare law and how they wrote the prescription laws. That's socializing them. So if you're going to be against socialism, then be completely against it, but don't be against it when it benefits you, doesn't benefit you, and be for it when it does. But that's $2 trillion we could save. So we wouldn't have to add a dollar of taxes or penalties to anyone to completely change America, our infrastructure, our forest, the quality of our land, support natural health, support the poor in ways that will help de-emphasize the needs that otherwise many youngs would have to go to gangs. Clean up America. We could do that if we chose to. The trouble is we do not have that on the agenda. We're not talking about it. That's how I believe we should start.
Thank you very much.
We're going to go to our guests in 2 minutes. Before we go, however, I got one caller coming in, Luann Panessi. Hi, Luann.
Hey, Gary. I want to let you know that since the announcement you made the other day about the homestead, I've gotten emails, I've gotten phone calls, and now you gave us a great idea. I think before the homesteaders go out and do their work for the day, they should either have a choice of having some rosemary or self-manipulation. I think that would be a great way to get more people to the homestead.
But just as long as they're not homesteading and doing their manual manipulation at the same time. You can get arrested for that in the Bronx. You're aware of that, aren't you, Luann?
I don't know. Not my area.
Okay. Well, here's what I would suggest. So that we're going way forward on this. Now we're almost there. If people are interested in homesteading projects, why don't they just call you? That's the best thing. I'm going to do this lecture on and answer a lot of questions on Sunday, just so people aren't inundating us with calls, but you can help them. Give them your number, please.
I'm going to give out my cell number because I'm going to be out of town. I'm at 973-766-2214. That's 973-766-2214.
Okay, good. So the first, we're beginning. It's going to take about 3 months of helping individuals develop the skills necessary for them to really understand what a transition movement is. going from point A to point B in a person's life, you need skills, you need tools, you need to understand what's involved, and so that's what this is going to be about. All right. Thank you, Luann. We're going to take a break and come back and, as promised, spend a lot of time with our guest, Dr. Paul Epstein, and we're going to talk about the climate changes in our planet and their influence on changes in our health and the future health of people. Dr. Paul Epstein is a medical physician trained in tropical public health and director at the Center for Health and the Global Environment at Harvard Medical School. He's worked extensively in Africa, Asia, Latin America, and oversaw the special 8-part series on health climate change published by the Lancet Journal. He has also worked closely with the International Panel on Climate Change, the National Academy of Sciences, NASA, and the UNDP, and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in forecasting the health impacts of global warming, and most importantly, tipping points due to climate change. For all of you who are listening, and we have the largest progressive audience in the world listening, please share this information with those who have accepted that climate change is not real, that climate warming is not real, that if there may be some warming, it has nothing to do with humans, and even if it does exist, it's not going to really impact us. Because, after all, we live in Boston, New York City, Philadelphia. We're not out in Bangladesh. We're not in Pakistan. We're not up at the bottom of the Himalayas or down past the Three Gorge Dam. So why should we be interested? You'll see in a moment. Please stay with us. Back with my guest. Nice to have you with us, everyone. On Sunday evening, we'll be talking about a lot of things, including overprescribed, how taking too many pills is hurting Americans. And then Monday evening, in the special one-hour program at 7 p.m., I'm going to start with a look at the Shanghai Cooperative Organization, the SCO, versus all of the other neocon and neoliberal free market and globalized perspectives on what we can do to make a positive change in the Middle East, especially Afghanistan. So that is going to be an interesting conversation, but again, it will take a whole hour. I want to do it in depth. Let's now go to my guest who's standing by. Nice to have you with us, Dr. Epstein.
Good afternoon, Gary. Good to be with you.
I would first like to ask you if you have any clear statistics so far showing that the rise in illnesses and deaths can be associated with climate change and global warming. And although we can witness this in the developing world, most people say, well, that's over there. It's not here or in Europe. But could you address this, please?
Sure. And let me just do a minor correction. I'm the associate director of our center. And then our publishers at UC Press will call me right away if I don't mention our new book, A Changing Planet, Changing Health, written with science writer Dan Ferber. So to get to your question, there are a couple of diseases that highlight where we're going with the impacts of climate change on our health. Lyme disease, for instance. Warm winters are key to the overwintering of ticks. And we've seen Lyme disease and reports go up eightfold in the last decade in New Hampshire, tenfold in Maine. It's throughout the state, all the way up to the border with Canada. This is even ahead of where our projections were because warming is occurring more during the winter and at nighttime, and also as one gets closer to the poles. So some of the biological responses, instead of being lagging, are in fact leading indicators. Asthma is another one, which has more than doubled in the U.S. in the last 25, 30 years. And there are several things related to fossil fuels. And just more carbon dioxide is giving us more ragweed pollen and tree pollen. Ozone levels are up and they irritate the lungs. Particles from burning fossil fuels attached to the pollen help deliver them. And then because of climate change, summer, the whole allergy and asthma season has been extended 2 to 4 weeks in the northern hemisphere, depending on the location and the latitude. So those are two really ongoing issues that are increased by climate and by burning fossil fuels.
I appreciate that. Thank you. One of the conundrums that we seem to be in constantly if we're involved in the environmental movement is the official position emanating from the official agencies is to downplay the significance of any worst-case scenario, that we're, in effect, we're conditioned to believe that nothing could get that bad. But could you just take a moment and chart the severe scenarios of the climate landscape that we may be entering, and what could be some of the most severe scenarios in realistic terms?
Sure. Well, that's a good question. Maybe there's three categories we could think of the way climate could change. It could change gradually, meaning gradual warming. Second, it could come with lots more extremes and variability and wide swings among the extremes. And then the third is that there could be tipping points, as you alluded to, where the system itself changes. The key to understanding all of these is what's happening in the deep ocean. Since the late 1950s, when we first started tracking temperatures in the oceans have absorbed 22 times as much heat as has the atmosphere and the continents. Another way of thinking of that is 95% of the last century's global warming is in the deep ocean. And that's what affects not just warming, but the extreme weather events. More warmer water evaporates faster. More water vapor is held in a warmed atmosphere. It's 7% more for every 1 degree C it warms. So there's a whole change in the water cycle. Water is warming, ice is melting, water vapor is rising, and this is creating droughts in some areas, which exacerbating droughts where they exist, but also leading to heavier downfalls, heavier storms. Katrina, for instance, if it had occurred in 1980, would not have been as strong as it was in 2005 because the warm water and the warm water that feeds it and feeds Rita, Wilma after Katrina is all building up, and this is the store that generates the extremes. Now, all this is also affecting ice cover. Both the warming of the ocean is melting Arctic ice, as well as the warming of the air. And that is what could lead to some trigger points and some changes in the ocean circulation. And those are the things that, this is the reflectivity of the Earth. About 30% of all the incoming radiation goes out because of the ice. If it goes down to 29, 28, more water, more warmth is absorbed in the water, and so on. It's a positive feedback, and that's the kind of thing that could lead to some major surprises. But I think we don't need to look that far for what's happened in the last year and a half throughout the planet, including the U.S. We're seeing an exaggeration of natural events, and that's what's key here. This is natural variability and climate change acting together to affect our weather patterns.
Recently, when I was in Texas, I noticed, because I owned a ranch in Texas, North Texas, for quite a few years, and I noticed one season after the other, it became hotter and hotter. And I began to study some of the weather patterns there, and I just saw the latest statistics that Texas is now in the longest drought in recorded history in the state since records were kept in 1890, and as much as 70% of the state is now without adequate water for its agriculture, for its animals. There's hundreds of thousands of cattle that have died. grass can't grow, and hence hay can't grow. Timothy, bahia, alfalfa, and wells are gone. And unfortunately, the rest of the country is not immune to this. Georgia is having it. North Florida is having it. Alabama is having it. And the largest aquifer in the United States, which is under the Corn Belt, is going down substantially, and there won't be adequate water to continue having a Corn Belt. We're going to have another Dust Belt in about 20 years at the current rate of usage. And then when you have Oklahoma and Nevada and New Mexico, much of much of California are also in severe drought, where we're not looking. We're just looking at the nice places to live. We're looking at the income and the real estate values. But the basics, just is there water there to be sustainable, people are not paying attention to. Could you share with us how much of this is right in front of us? It's no secret, and yet we don't seem to be interested in this information.
Well, as you paint quite the picture, and drought is really the silent killer of this issue. And having lived in Africa myself, I've been in some really dense droughts that affect what people drink, their hygiene, what they grow. And what you're picturing here is a really evolving issue that we've thought about for years, food security. And water problems, many of the aquifers are overdrawn and underfed to begin with. This is going to exacerbate that. And food security, because of these kinds of droughts, because of the floods as well along the Mississippi and flooding farmlands and homesteads, and then what we've seen globally in the last year, Russia, the heat wave last year knocked their wheat crop for 40%. Pakistan had floods. Australia had floods affecting wheat. China now has floods after droughts. And we're facing already rising food prices. There are many reasons for that. There's more demand for meat. There's biofuel use. There's higher fuel costs. But it's the climate variability and the extremes that has really almost doubled the price of grains globally over the last year. And this is related to political stability as well. So I'm afraid we're already seeing some of the things we forecasted for many years ahead, and you're right, spot on, that water and food production become the leading problems for us related to climate change.
Water we can't live without, and yet less than 1% of the world's actual water is clean, healthy drinking water, and we don't seem to be paying attention to this cycle and what happens when we deforest the Amazon, where in parts of the great Amazon, there's two longest rivers in the world, the Nile and the Amazon. And I'm doing a new documentary on the 12 tipping points, and you go down the Amazon now, you just fly over it, and you'll see that in some villages that historically have been right on the Amazon River, they're back 500 feet. And it's because of the change in weather patterns, in no small measure due to the thousands of acres per day, the hectares that they're taking out of being rainforest, and then planting soybean to feed China's population, their meat and pork, and India's and needs and other needs. And they don't seem to be paying attention. And their mind is, A, the Chinese are paying us above market value to rent land or buy land. B, there's an unlimited amount of money to be made because there's more money to get from China for mouths that need to have food, and they want the American diet. So we do take, you know, 1 million acres in the next year and a half out of production, or put it into production, take it away from being natural water reserves and carbon holding sinks. So what? And I'm saying, so what? Do you realize how much of this great Amazon you've destroyed, the species, the medicinal value from the trees and the barks and the plants, the people? And Americans are absolutely unaware that this is happening. And in fact, most people around the world are unaware that we are destroying some of the great creators of hydration, creators of of sustainability, we're taking them away. Could you address these, not only there, but also China's massive need to grow at 10, 9, 11% per year without thinking about, are they able to do it in a sustainable way? Or have they done it in a way that's created one of the greatest encroachments of desert and desertification in the world? Could you address these, please?
Sure. You've hit a lot of issues, and just to sort of be crass and gross for a moment, 80% of the carbon problem is burning fossil fuels. 20% of it is forests. And by taking down the forests, we are also affecting the carbon dioxide that's left in the atmosphere, which is what absorbs heat and is responsible for the enhanced greenhouse effect. Now, what's happening in the Amazon of removing trees is also changing the local water cycle and contributing to drought in the Amazon itself, which then exacerbates the deforestation. Yes, our agricultural practices and our need for food and feed and fiber is coming to a breaking point in terms of land availability and water availability. And, these are things that the climate community have pointed to, projected, for decades off into the future. But these are coming to fruition today, unfortunately. And we're seeing the economic impacts. We're seeing the grain price impacts. We're seeing political instability in Uganda, in Burkina Faso. A lot of what's exacerbated the upheavals in North Africa and Middle East, food prices, fuel prices, these have all played a role. So I do think we are really seeing the unfolding of this issue, and we have to move to some major solutions fast that both stimulate the global economy and drive us towards a transition to healthy, clean energy systems.
I have just two more questions. One will deal with the list of illnesses that you mentioned, but I would like to add a few to see if you believe that they're associated with climate change and global warming. And then last, give us your solutions. Our program prides itself on having positive solutions for all of our negative problems. Yes, we have to be honest about our problems, and I believe we have not been as a society. But we also then have to be vigorous about looking for all the truths that we can change this. So the first issue is, would you include malaria, cholera, dengue fever, which we now have a few cases in the United States, West Nile virus? You mentioned Lyme's disease. How about waterborne pathogens like Salmonella and pathogenic E. coli, since already we are witnessing large storms and flooding? You mentioned asthma and allergies. How about malnutrition and the immune disorders associated with it, and particularly speak on this in the context of decreasing crop yields and the rising costs here in the United States?
Well, you've, again, hit a lot of hot spots here. In terms of the infectious disease, warming affects the potential range of the conditions conducive to transmission of things like malaria, dengue fever, West Nile as well. And so one sees in the mountains of Africa and Asia and Latin America, for instance, exactly where glaciers are retreating, plant communities are moving up the mountains, and we're seeing malaria and dengue fever at high altitudes. So Nairobi is a mile-high city. It has malaria circulating, and yes, dengue fever has reached the Keys, but we have pretty good control here of mosquitoes. I'm not sure that's the major issue. The other that comes with the warming is the extreme weather events. And flooding can generate clusters of the waterborne disease like cholera or E. coli or Salmonella, waterborne, rodent-borne like hantavirus, as well as spread toxins and also mosquito-borne. So it's the warming that affects the range. It's the extremes that affect the timing, intensity, location of outbreaks. You're absolutely right. Malnutrition is a key issue that underlies all of our health issues. And you're right to come back to this. Public health is not just about the bugs that bite us. It has to do with the bugs that are eating some of the forests and propensity to fires and so on. But it's the underlying issues of nutrition, of water, of habitat, both in the oceans and on land, that underlie our public health. And these are the things that are most threatened by climate change.
I do have one last short question before your solutions part. By the way, for those of you who are just rounding out the end of this hour, listening on land-based stations throughout the United States, Dr. Paul Epstein is my guest, and his book is called Changing Planet, Changing Health, How the Climate Crisis Threatens Our Health and What We Can Do About It. And we will be continuing to conclude our interview if you listen over the Internet at progressiveradionetwork.com. Now, my short question is this. One of my personal concerns is the increase in monoculture in agriculture, Monsanto, BSF, and DuPont. I believe that they had their way without any resistance. Biodiversity of food crops and plants would be way down on the list of priorities. How do you predict the increase over reliance on pesticides, fertilizers, and the chemical industry to produce these chemicals in order to keep sufficient food supplies, ultimately affecting the health of people and including the GMOs, especially when you have flooding now, and that flooding is carrying all of those pesticides and all those chemicals, whatever they may be, in genetic species in ways that we never would have seen before, including hundreds if not thousands of miles down the Missouri and the Mississippi. They're flooding now.
Well, again, you point to a major issue, and with the crop pests that are affected by climate change, as well as the weeds that grow more with carbon dioxide, we're going to face more, and flooding that fosters fungi, we may face the use of more pesticides, herbicides, and fungicides to control some of the impacts of what's going on. Diversity is clearly a protective measure for agriculture, and monocropping is certainly makes them more vulnerable. That's a perfect segue into some of the solutions. If that's fine, I'll move that way.
Yes.
Hello?
Yeah.
Okay. So if we think about solutions to this conundrum we're in, we can think of what we need to do and then how do we pay for it. In terms of what we need to do, we look at healthy solutions, and we look through the health lens to understand coal and nuclear and oil and natural gas and fracking and so on. If we look at the positive, healthy solutions, we need electric vehicles of all types. We need to plug them into a cleanly powered smart grid, and that's something we need to be building today, a smart, efficient, computerized grid. And then in cities, we need green buildings, rooftop gardens, tree-lined streets, biking lanes, walking paths, permeable surfaces, open space, public transport, and smart growth, all connecting them with light rail. Those are things that we could be doing today, and those would be healthy, they would stimulate the economy, and they would help launch these technologies for climate stabilization into the global marketplace. How do we pay for all these wonderful things? We need to find sources of funds that don't depend on nations, because we're all facing debt and some even deficit and default, and we need to find a way of raising funds. The Europeans now are projecting a levy on currency transactions, which sounds complicated, but it's really the bets on money every day, which is about $4 trillion every trading day. And a little levy on that is what the Europeans are considering just for their own problems, but that kind of levy could generate hundreds of billions of dollars a year that could be used for illness, could be used for agriculture that's sustainable, and also for the clean energy transformation.
I appreciate those. One final thought from my own side on this. I believe at some point we must look at how we can get people out of driving the cars as much as they do and flying airplanes, and instead look at a public service, like taking one of the Chinese technologies of their fast rails. If you were to go from New York to Florida, New York to Los Angeles, stops in Chicago, they're able now to go between 200 and 250 miles an hour. They employed people to get there. Think of the jobs we could create. Think of how we could encourage people to use public transportation instead of private, what that would do to save the public money and give them a convenient and safe way to get from point A to point B. We have not had such a program in a long time, and I believe that we need a national initiative to gain more understanding of the environmental benefit and overall cost benefit to us of this kind. Your final thought on this?
Couldn't agree more. This is what we need for our health, for the economy, and to stabilize the climate.
Thank you very much. I appreciate being on with us today, Dr. Paul Epstein.
Thank you, Gary. Pleasure to talk with you.
Dr. Paul Epstein, speaking to him from Harvard Medical School. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more on Sunday evening, 8 p.m. over Progressive Radio Network. This afternoon, you have some really progressive minds coming at you. Robert Knight, Polk-winning award investigative reporter who takes on the issues. And he's the type of reporter that can look at an issue without blinking out of fear. He is non-political. He seeks the truth. Few do. And also Hugh Hamilton, outstanding journalist who takes on social issues in a fair and very even-mannered way. He's one of the people that brought etiquette back, the decency of being able to disagree without fighting someone. There's no need in progressive circles for dominance of ego, but rather sharing and cooperating in dissemination of ideas. Have a nice day, everyone.
When you were young and your heart was an open book, you used to say, live and let die.
The Gary Knoll Show is produced in our New York City studio. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matt Bogart. All shows are archived by Joe Kemp. The chief archivist is Sharon Pride, and the program director is Jason Tavenfeld.